From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. When Quentin Tarantino makes a movie, you know it's because he wants to make a movie, because he does them when he's ready to. From Reservoir Dogs to Pulp Fiction to Jackie Brown to the Kill Bill movies, and now he's working on another double feature, part of a double feature. His part of the film Grindhouse is Death Proof. Quentin, first of all, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's good to be here. I've been looking forward to coming here for a long time.
I should ask you at this point to tell the audience what it's about.
It's a double feature film with Robert Rodriguez and I, and we're trying to bring back, it's called Grindhouse, and we're trying to bring back the whole grindhouse experience of going to the movies in the 70s. And we did it with a double horror film double feature. Robert's is kind of a zombie movie called Planet Terror, and mine is a high-octane slasher film at 200 miles an hour called Death Proof. But part of the thing is we're trying to actually, along with doing these two movies, we're trying to recreate that entire experience with trailers and just, you know, what it was like to go to the movies back then. You know, I'm sure you as well have watched over the last two decades how, you know, whatever pomp and circumstance or ballyhoo of theater exhibition that used to exist, we've watched for the last two decades that be actually cut down to nothing. I mean, used to you go to a movie and everything wasn't at a multiplex. Not that I don't like the multiplexes, but, you know, theaters used to be a little bigger. And then, you know, you'd go to see a film and there'd be a whole set of lobby cards in the lobby. And there'd be big posters and, like, the bigger theaters, you know, a giant mural, you know, stretching from the marquee, and everything was boom. I'm talking about even the exploitation movies. You went and saw Hitman, all right, by George Armitage, you know, in downtown L.A., and it was like a gigantic 10-foot-tall, you know, Hitman mural painted. And you saw movies and trailers and cartoons in the middle, maybe even a travelogue, all kinds of, like, it was, you got a night out. That was an evening's entertainment. And now it's kind of just been down, reduced to you rent a seat for 2 hours. And not only that, you even have to watch commercials in front of it. You remember the days when you used to actually get stoned and go to the movies to, you know, watch the movie stoned? Maybe you get stoned in the parking lot and you get stoned before you get to the theater. Well, like, now you can't even do that because you've got like five commercials that are just completely killing your buzz.
Well, the theaters I grew up going to, they were getting stoned in the theaters before the movie started. But I've got to ask you, too, just because of the way the movie is structured, it's sort of like two different, almost two sort of discrete pieces, but with very sort of different emotional climaxes. Yeah. How you worked your way into that, I mean, because for this movie, and it really is clear in this one as much as more so than the others, you use really character to explicate plot, yeah, rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what that working process is like for you.
Well, you know, the thing that happened with this film that was very, very unique. One, it's actually the first script that I've written since Reservoir Dogs, where I kind of came up with an idea, you know, oh, hey, this is a really good idea, and sat down and wrote it. All the other stuff, you know, I'd had in my mind for a while. Even like in Pulp Fiction, the John Travolta, Uma Thurman story had been something I'd had in my mind for a long time. So I was, oh, okay, now it's time. And then some of the other stories I came up with. Kill Bill had been around for a long time, even in my brain. Even Jackie Brown, I'd read it before and thought about making it into a movie. This was the first one that I actually just kind of, oh, came up with an idea and sat down and here we go and let it all come forward. And that was really exciting. But one of the things about it, though, was I've never written a play. But when I was I could have done Reservoir Dogs as a play. I just didn't want to. It actually was an impediment when I was trying to get it made. Everyone, that's a play. But when I was writing, especially like the early bar scenes for the first half of the movie of Death Proof, and the girls are hanging out in the bar, it was like, gosh, this could be a play. In fact, if I didn't have to hurry up and get to my car chase coming up, I could just let them sit in this bar for the next 90 minutes. But just in that regard, I did just end up telling the entire story through the girls talking. And again, trying never to be on the money about it. I always try to bury – again, it's not even a try to. It just kind of happens. I always try to bury anything that's plot-oriented or anything that's going to has to pay off later, just buried amongst a bunch of minutiae dialogue. So you don't know that you're being set up for something. You don't know you've actually been told the plot. You don't know that the breadcrumbs have been led for something else later to happen. So when it doesn't, oh, that's what that was about. But I just, you know, I hate when people open their mouths and just say exposition. I always want to hide it and marble it with all this other, you know, free talking.
Speaking of free talking, it's Quentin Tarantino, writer-director of Death Proof, part of the Grindhouse double feature. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. I've got to ask you because first and foremost, your movies are so much for me about emotional territory. And it's interesting to see it from a woman's point of view. It's not so competitive, but still about people trying to stake their claim in a group. Even, I mean, the very first scene we see in your very first film, it's happening.
Yeah.
And that sort of sets the tone. And because the emphasis is different, it's kind of hard to sort of really detect it. You've got to look for it a little bit, but it's always there. And I wonder for you if in your groups of friends or in movies you saw, if you kind of felt that and you could sort of watch that happen and just sort of sunk in for you in some way.
Well, you know, I mean, I was actually thinking about this the other day. Men are, you know, young males are actually quite abusive to each other. All right, you're always ragging on each other. You're always making fun of each other. If somebody does something slightly stupid, you always jump on them with both feet. Like, and you quickly get mad. I mean, it's over in 2 seconds, but like, oh, you idiot. What an idiot. You did that. And then it's over with. But it's very, very kind of abusive. And what's actually funny is if you get like I was with my friends in video archives, you know, working at this one store with this one group of guys for like 5 years, when you get so used to that dynamic, the minute you take yourself into another dynamic, you realize you're overreacting to everything. What, you stupid idiot? You didn't answer the phone? It's okay, Quentin. It was just the phone. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm used to talking to Jerry and Steve-O.
The thing that sort of struck me about this movie is one of the first times when there's not a real monologue, a soliloquy, somebody gets to deliver. There's a real community of people talking. And it's usually a catalyst in the scripts that you write where somebody gets a monologue.
Right.
It's the sort of thing that wouldn't seem real if you didn't have the right actor doing it. But you pick somebody who really sings it, not delivers it, but sings it. I mean, treats it as an aria. But here that doesn't happen so much. I wonder if that was a specific and kind of deliberate departure on your part.
Well, you know, it's, you know, the truth of the matter is, if you're doing a movie that, like, you know, is filled with monologues and stuff like that, well, you need to actually find those type of actors. You know, it's actually one of the things that I have learned over the course of doing, you know, the number of films I've done and have working with my own material so much is I can never forget that ultimately it's about my material. You got to be able to do my dialogue. You got no business on my set. And it's so easy to get, like, caught up in an actor that they have a neat idiosyncratic quality and you think that's sexy and boy, that wouldn't that be interesting. But at the end of the day, if they can't deliver my dialogue, basically if they can't sing it, they got to sing it. If they can't sing it, if they can't deliver my jokes and if they don't even know they are jokes, they got to get the jokes. They got to be smart enough to get it and they got to be able to sing it. You know, Sam Jackson's and Christopher Walken's don't grow on trees. But since I'm actually looking for younger girls in this movie, especially like I said in the first half of it, I wanted it more about a give and take. And it might seem artificial if all of a sudden the girls just started, you know, spouting off gigantic, you know, monologues. On the other hand, in the second half, that's where the dialogue to me gets like extremely musical. Especially when Tracy Toms and Zoe Bell start going back and forth and Rosario starts going back. Actually, those are where the monologues come in, is the second half. Because, you know, that's also like there's kind of a more faster pace in that. You're not just like watching the girls just lounge around. You know, we're at the final part of both this movie and Grindhouse. And to me, that's where the music starts getting really – that's when the characters start really singing the dialogue. And I actually think Tracy Toms pretty much is my female Sam Jackson.
I think so too. But, I mean, I thought of like just watching the movies to get ready for this about how musicals – and you never talk about musicals much in interviews – but how much musicals must influence the way you work in some – I don't know if it's subliminal or how conscious it is for you. But the way the actors approach the dialogue – you talked about a play. It feels more to me like a real sort of old school musical where somebody gets a number. Even the violence is sort of like musical numbers.
Oh, well, you know, but I see – I've always felt that's the mechanics of the cinematic set piece. it is like a musical number because it's outside of the body of the piece, but yet it is what the body of the piece is about. You know, when you're watching, and not that I've seen that many Broadway musicals, but when all of a sudden, you know, okay, they're coming up to that big song that you've been waiting for, and then bam, it happens, and it's like the whole show stops to give you this mini show. And I've even had the experience, like especially when I saw Chicago on Broadway. After they did this one song, I knew that would be the best song in the movie on the play. So, like, okay, now I have to suffer through the next half hour because I know they've just topped themselves. There's nothing good after this point coming on.
So what do you do to keep that sort of thing where people – you sort of feel that and you sort of like check out from the movie. You know what I'm saying? Oh, you know it's going to be the high point.
Yeah.
And you sort of like detach from it. What do you – obviously you structure to answer or to counter that in some way, don't you?
Well, yes. Well, I mean, you know, I always like using people's subliminal knowledge of cinema against them. You know, most people don't think that much about it as far as like story structure or this, but they internally understand it. Simply because they've seen it so damn many times. So it is actually a lot of fun to give them those breadcrumbs that lead them down this way and then, you make a big left turn and take them down somewhere else. And they didn't even know they were being led down somewhere. They just felt it. And then I take the rug out from under them.
Which is actually what a number of exploitation pictures do. And I always wonder why people – let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. People end up reacting so badly. A lot of the critics who reviewed these movies in the 70s, mm-hmm. not all, but a lot, because they were upset that their expectations of convention had been thwarted.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very much so. But you know what's also truly interesting to me is – like, and I'm not always the guy, oh, everything was better back when I was younger. All right? Try not to be that guy. All right? But like there is this aspect though of when you look at something like Macon County Line. One of my biggest problems of like scripts nowadays, movies nowadays, is – we used to be – America was known as – we were the storytellers. Other film industries could invest in minutiae, character, atmosphere, environment, playing with cinema. But, you know, we were the storytellers. That's what we did. Well, we're probably the worst at it now in world cinema as far as I'm concerned because, you know, a story – it's not a situation. A story is a story. A story is always unfolding. If you're listening to a story, you don't know everything there is in the first 20 minutes of a story. You know, the story starts and then it's this. And then by the middle, it's become something else. And by the end, whoa. And if you actually were to go to the end of it and then hop to the front and go, oh, how did I get to there from here? Well, that's a story. What movies are now pretty much a lot of times – they're movie versions of situation comedies. They set up a situation in the first 20 minutes, and then the rest of the movie is just living up to that situation. And sometimes they can pull it off, and it can be really exciting, but it's not a story. Now, I bring that up because looking at Macon County Line, I showed it to the cast and stuff. By comparison to the scripts written in Hollywood today, that is a very sophisticated piece of work. Because it has this constantly unfolding story of these drifters come through, there's two guys, they're on their way to the army, and then in a weekend they're on the buddy system, so they're just cutting through the South in the 50s. They end up picking up a girl. There's all this really natural dialogue, a very good Southern redneck dialogue from the 50s, but not like Klansman-ish. It's just authentic rednecks talking. And they're messing around. Then they go into the Macon County, and we meet the sheriff. And then these whole series of events happens that eventually – and all very believable, eventually makes the sheriff think that they killed his wife. And the last little bit is him going after them and killing them, and they don't know why they're being chased or what the deal is. There is a lot of unfolding. There is a lot of storytelling going on here, and they don't just jump to anything, and it's just constantly, constantly unfolding in a very, very well-done way. Now, if they're going to remake Macon County Line now, it'll all be about the last 20 minutes. They would jump to the fact that the sheriff thinks these strangers have killed his wife and the whole thing would be his hunt for them.
My guest is Quentin Tarantino. His new film is writer, director, and cinematographer, by the way, is Death Proof, part of the Grindhouse double feature. I'm Elvis Mitchell. More on rednecks and musicals in a moment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Thank you.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is writer-director Quentin Tarantino. His new film is Death Proof, part of the Grindhouse double feature. Now, what you're talking about in that way that movies used to seem like they were digressive, but in fact they were discursive. I mean, all these digressions, because you think about what a great joke is, there's something that sort of sets up what the situation is. And what you want to get is the audience's attention. And that setup is a kind of misdirection.
Yeah.
But it's also a way to get people to trust you and invest in the emotional situation so that when that happens, they're really going along with it, which is what you do twice in Death Proof, which is a really incredibly sort of awful burden to set up for yourself, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's funny because the film isn't Death Proof. It isn't a slasher film, but it uses the structure of a slasher film, especially in the first half. In particular, though, the slasher film structure of, you know, of the 80s, where one of the things I love about slasher films is you know, their structure. What makes them fun is they're all kind of the same. I mean, it's such a strong – I actually think it's probably the most rigid structure in subgenres with the exception possibly of women in prison films. But that is part of its fun. That's why Carol J. Clover can write that great book, Men, Women, and Chainsaws, and be pretty damn correct because every movie fits the bill. And not only that, when they kind of don't fit the bill, when they monkey with the structure a little too much, well, now it's kind of not even a slasher film. So when I was actually coming up with this, I figured out that's what I wanted to do. But oh, God. They're so the same, that'll just be too self-reflective. Now that's just too outside of itself. So, you know, I came up with my own version with this guy's got a car that's death-proof. He can crash into a car and kill everybody in the other car, but he'll survive it. But I still wanted to use the slasher film structure where you kind of set up the final girl. Because every slasher film usually starts off with a female posse. They almost always start off with them. You know, you see their dynamic. There's the loose one. There's this one, the popular one. There's the one that's just a little at odds with her friends, just a little bit, a little odd girl out. And that's the one that usually is the final girl. She's the one, as Carol J. Clover says, has the investigative gaze, which is a purely masculine trait in cinema, not in life, but in cinema is a masculine trait. And slasher films were the only ones that gave it to women.
But that's always, in those slasher movies, sort of contrasted with the virginal thing because she was not distracted by sex.
Yes.
So she could actually have that gaze.
Well, and that was it. That was like, you know, she had the mortal fortitude to vanquish the boogeyman because, you know, she was more or less pure. But then actually one of the things that's great about that book, to get off subject for a nanosecond, is what's so great about that book is the way Carol J. Clover really describes that how the killer and the final girl actually have so much in common. And they are weird inversions of men and there's the monster actually is quite feminized at some point. And actually when she actually does kill him and slash him, that actually is her virginity being broken. She's actually having sex with the boogeyman. And also, the boogeyman is a virgin almost always. He's at odds. There's something wrong about him. He doesn't fit in. It's only their virginal antennas are what connect them to each other.
But in Death Proof, we were talking to Quentin Tarantino about his new film, Death Proof, which is part of the Grindhouse double feature. That sexual aspect is missing from this movie. What those movies did was, because we didn't have the Playboy Channel or cable everywhere, they would tease with nudity and the sex scenes.
I just don't tease with nudity. I tease with, like, as skimpy as the clothes can be, all right? Like, my film is definitely drowning in ass, feet, boobs, and legs.
There are sexual aspects, sexual connotations, but not a specific kind of sexuality.
Here's the deal. I'm just, like, I'm almost even a little embarrassed about it. I'm just a little too much of a gentleman to ask my actresses to do that. It's just that simple. I mean, if I was going to make a real sexual movie, well, then that would be okay. They would all know it. When they walked into the door, even for the audition, the label would be clearly marked. And then and if you're not down with that, then get the hell out. But you know, short of that.
That to me was a fascinating choice because you're really making it about the people. I mean, you're not allowing that kind of disengagement.
No,
that nudity and those kinds of things offer.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, I was very, very, you know, you might even say overly precious. I fell in love with my own little creations, and I loved their voice. And the thing that I liked the most about it was the fact that not only do these girls sound like real women I've known and real gals I've known, but they sound like girls right now. It's not me remembering back to, oh, yeah, I remember in college when the girls would say this or that and the other. They're right now, and the text messaging is right now. I mean, the references they make, the slang they use is right now.
Because of the dialogue, you're sort of asking for that kind of emotional investment right away,
yeah.
Even though you do the thing that you often do in the movies where there's a climactic moment of violence that makes us question everything that's gone before and then who these characters are going to be. I mean, that's the thing that feels a bit like you to me in this, that beat where, oh, my God, he did this. Now what?
Yeah, no, there's definitely that. And also I was really also kind of playing again with your emotions about the violence because there's a big – collision crash in this movie. And it's, you know, I don't even think I'm giving anything away now. It's death proof. What do you expect it to be? All right, he's killing girls with a car. What do you think is going to happen? But the thing is, part of the thing is like there's this music playing and these cars are speeding towards each other. And if I did it right, you want that crash to happen. You're caught up in it. You're caught up in the emotion. You're caught in the adrenaline forward. And if at the last second they avoided it, you'd be mad at me. You'd say, oh, well, you stopped it. So then when the – so you are complicit. But then when it happens, it's so horrible and you're like, oh, I didn't want that. Too late. You're already complicit. So I do love – I love to set up the violence so you enjoy it. But then, okay, while you're enjoying it, remember. And, you feel a little nasty about it now. Maybe a little wrong about it now. Too bad.
But it's that sense of just sort of pulling, as you said, pulling the rug off from under people, which a lot of those movies were very shameless about doing at a time where movies didn't do that. Because you're talking about what movies are like now. A lot of the big studio pictures of the 60s were very much about sort of laying out conventions and following them through because they were movies that the entire family saw together.
Yeah.
And we're talking about movies that were made for an audience that wasn't going to see a movie with their parents.
Yeah.
So they got to sort of get teased and beat up and humiliated and pulled into a movie in the way that the whole family had not before that.
Oh, that's a really good point that I hadn't thought about before. And, you know, to me, that was one of the joys of especially exploitation cinema in the 70s was, you know, I saw everything, not just exploitation stuff. But the thing is, that was the stuff that, you know, it played by their own rules. You know, you weren't going to see the stuff that happened in Fernando de Leo's Wipeout happen in Barbra Streisand's Star is Born.
I wish I had. You're listening to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is writer, director, and cinematographer Quentin Tarantino. His new film is Death Proof, part of the Grindhouse double feature. But that's just that sense of just saying this, it was a genre that was inventing itself.
Yeah.
I mean, before the slasher film became so codified and those sort of like social movies that were really exploitation films like Last House on the Left became so sort of specific and reiterating things before.
But then even, you know, also what was also interesting to me about those times is like, you know, I'm just looking at, say, like the woman in prison movies out of the Philippines as an example. All right. Now, when you're looking at the Jack Hill ones like Big Dollhouse, Big Birdcage, you're talking about actually – you know, actually quite sophisticated satires going on, especially in the rhythmic use of dialogue. All right. And in the case of like Switchblade Sisters, his non-rhythmic use of dialogue is like all the notes are bad and that makes its own music. But there was a lot of comedy in them. There was a lot of sex, a lot of violence, but a lot of humor going on. And, you know, he was a quite satiric artist. And I know he didn't write the dialogue of all of his scripts, but it seemed, since they, like Howard Hawks, they all seemed to sound like a Jack Hill movie.
And
I'm sure he had some play
in
it.
That kind of sense of emotional momentum that we got in Howard Hawks movies, too. I mean, that sort of speed, that velocity, you know.
Oh,
that.
Very much so. And again, also kind of not even believing that you actually, you don't know when you started investing in these characters, but by the end, you were completely invested in them. And when did that happen?
But see, because what we're talking about here is archetype versus character.
Yeah.
And the Jack Hill movies always start off as being archetypal and moved into something else.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of start these movies here in that same way. Yeah. We think we're seeing archetypes and you're playing with our perception of who these archetypes or what they represent, and then in fact become something very different because you pull us into it right away.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, if there's like one question hanging over Grindhouse going into finally locking it and saying that's it is, did I make a mistake by having so much dialogue in my half of the movie? Because it's got to work as this whole experience. Now, Roberts is just breakneck, all right? It's just balls out from beginning to end, and that's the whole first half of the night. And he's actually set the pace up that way. And then you get a little reprise with the trailer as a little palate cleanser, and then mine starts. Well, mine's not breakneck. at all. You kind of get to know the characters, and then there's this big cataclysmic moment, and then then more dialogue. You know, a whole new set of characters, and you kind of luxuriate with them with their dialogue, leading to a big climax. That is exciting, and hopefully it ends the whole night. But, you know, there was some questions. You know, can the audience handle this dialogue? Are we changing the rhythm too much? And my whole feeling was, well, look, this was never supposed to be Twilight Zone the movie. This was supposed to be a double feature. And not only that, it's like, you know, I have confidence in how double features work because I program double features. Either at my house, in Austin, at the Alamo, what's going on at the New Beverly right now in Los Angeles. You know, I program them. I'm not afraid of the double feature concept. But not only that, I actually figured people, you know, they don't want to see a movie with the sameness to it. They want to see a Robert Rodriguez movie and a Quentin Tarantino movie. And my whole thing is like, well, you know, if people don't like the talking in my movies, then they don't like my movies, all right? My fans want to see the talk. I think the dialogue is witty, it's charming, it's funny, and you're really getting to know these women. I mean, you get to really know. I actually think you end up knowing the second group of girls even more than the first group of girls. And the proof is in the pudding. Are they screaming during the chase at the end? You know, there literally is five moments in that chase that the audience has to react. It has to spike. They have to go, ooh, If they do that, then I've done my job right. I handled it correct. And maybe it was a little slow there, but you were getting to know these girls. And now when that chase happens, now you know them. You know them and you're invested in them and you don't want them to die and you're with them. And not only am I having to introduce them to you, I'm having to introduce them to you in the middle of a movie, in leading to hour three of this entire experience.
Are you a little worried about that? Because it's a long time investment for an audience to make. What are your concerns about that?
Well, you know, I mean, again, I think, you know, if you're going to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. It is a double feature. All right. So it's not it's not even a faux double feature. Now, I always knew from the beginning it would be a real double feature. All right. You know, other people were like, well, it's not been an hour each. Yeah, right. No, it's going to be a real double feature. Having said that, I think the night works really good. I think it works really, really good. But again, that is also what we're selling. We're not selling a long movie. We're selling a nighttime experience. We're selling a whole night, two movies. And it is the experience. It's actually, if we do our jobs right, look, Planet Terror's got to work as Planet Terror. And it's like you could yank it out and show it by itself, and it delivers. Death Proof has got to work by itself. Yank it out, show it, it delivers. But then there's Grindhouse. And that's a whole other thing that we made. And the thing about that is that if that experience works correctly, then it's actually even a little closer to a ride, a Grindhouse ride, than just a movie. You know, it's sensation all the way through, even in the trailers, even in the coming attraction ads, everything. That's just – it's this Grindhouse experience.
We're out of time. Quentin, thanks so much for doing this. Will you come back and do the show
again?
I'd
be happy to.
My guest is Quentin Tarantino. His new film is writer, director, cinematographer, and co-star is Death Proof. Our technical director is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Bradley produces the program. I'm excited. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.